New Zealanders want and deserve a transparent and comprehensive inquiry into the COVID-19 response, not another whitewash. That's why RCR is bringing you a special segment aimed at examining the terms of reference, as well as what the country's best and brightest minds believe should be put on the table and why. The inquiry sessions will endeavour to unpack everything we already know and all the things we still don't know about how the COVID response was handled and what needs to be included in any new inquiry so that New Zealanders can get answers, justice and a future free from government overreach. Welcome to the inquiry sessions.
Keeping the COVID inquiry honest, it's Professor John Gibson from Waikato University, PhD from Stanford University, economist, very, very good with numbers. We're going to be looking at the excess deaths, what the officials say, what the politicians are saying, what the health experts are saying, and what the reality is, and the reaction to that reality. I'm Rodney Hyde, keeping the COVID inquiry honest here on RCR. When you're studying economics in the States and you meet someone with a PhD from Stanford in economics, you doff your cap. Isn't that right, John?
Oh, I'm not so sure. Stanford's fallen on slightly hard times. You probably noticed that the Sam Bankman-Fried, the FTX fellow in jail, his parents were Stanford Law School professors. His girlfriend was the daughter, or remains the daughter, of the head of the department at MIT Economics. And so I think the mighty also have feet of clay.
Indeed. Indeed. But back when you did it, it was the economics department was serious. That's a very impressive PhD. And of course, you've researched and taught economics around the world. The point is, you're not someone just coming in here with an opinion. By the way, I listen a lot to Victor Davis Hanson, who's a classicist and military historian, and he's based at the Hoover Institute at Stanford University. And hardly a week goes by when he doesn't describe the complete failure of Stanford University. His mother taught there, was a graduate there from the law school. And it's particularly heartbreaking to see these great institutions, not just the Sam Bankman-Fried, but actually just the wokeness and the anti-reason that's befallen them. It's a terrible thing, isn't it?
Yeah, I guess the lesson is that arguments should be evaluated on their merits. And so if you have people listening into this show when it plays, then hopefully they can, I can make a convincing case in terms of the merits of the argument. And whether my PhD was Stanford or Lincoln or whatever really shouldn't matter. And it should be the merits of the case. And indeed, if I sort of segue into this a little bit, your former colleague, I assume you overlapped in caucus with David Seymour, or did he follow you?
No, he followed me some years.
Yeah.
Later.
You know, and I've never met the man, and he'll probably never meet me, but there were kind of some of his comments, I think, on your radio show, I think with Paul Brennan rather than with you, sort of said, Oxford University had publishes this website and says this, and it's kind of argument by authority rather than saying, well, here's the actual guts of the argument. Let's lay out the guts of the argument rather than appealing to the aura of Oxford or a Harvard or a Stanford. And it's much better, I think, to Popper said, scientists can make bold conjectures, but then they have to be subject to critical attempts at refutation. So, yeah.
Indeed. Well, of course, David Seymour is a politician and you are an economist and researcher, and a politician doesn't like to be shown mistakes and to be shown to be wrong because it makes them fallible. And researchers following Sir Karl Popper love having their mistakes pointed out to them because that's how you improve your understanding and knowledge, right?
Yeah, in an ideal world, we might all be big enough that we ourselves set about critically refuting our own bold conjectures. But that probably requires attributes of individuals which have not been popular in recent years, let's put it that way. But we would hope that at the very least the system could do that, and so there could be a level playing field of ideas, and so other people might put out bold conjectures and then other people set about trying to refute them. And indeed the excess deaths issue, I think, can illustrate that, because there are a number of bold conjectures being made by people from public health and media and politics. You know, the vaccine saved X thousand lives, where X is some number greater than one. Elimination is the best strategy for dealing with respiratory pandemics. Those are both bold conjectures, and scientists are allowed to do that. But what seems to have been the case is that rather than setting about and said, okay, well, here's a conjecture, now let's set about trying to refute that, there seems to have been more attempts of saying, oh, look, this data series agrees with it. It's more like verificationism. And so, yes. Which, of course, Popper was particularly opposed to that.
Don't you love the work of Karl Popper?
Yeah, and I think all New Zealanders, you know, because of course he spent some years at the University of what's now the University of Canterbury, was would have been Canterbury College of the University of New Zealand, I think, and wrote Open Society and Its Enemies. You probably know this story, and I hope we don't get too far off topic. Eric Crampton, you probably know Eric, of course. Yes. He got a few years ago published something which had come from the archives of University of Canterbury, and essentially the university was telling Mr. Popper off for using too many pencils and notepads writing his manuscript, and he was meant to be there teaching. And so,
oh, indeed, and in fact, he wrote that in his biography, and he was treated appallingly at the University of Canterbury. He was given a huge teaching load. Of course, outside a narrow clique of European philosophers, he wasn't known. It was his first post in university. He'd previously been a cabinet maker. And he wasn't well known. And he was writing one of the great books, Open Society and Its Enemies, his war work, and given a huge teaching load. I'll tell you a wonderful story. We got time. It's my show. John Eccles was a New Zealand researcher at Otago. And people used to go to Sir Karl Popper's. He wasn't Sir Karl Popper then, he got knighted in the 60s, but he was. Used to go to his lectures, who weren't even taking his courses. And John Eccles, who was a researcher, travelled up from Otago to attend a seminar given by Sir Karl Popper. And came to see Karl Popper after the seminar, troubled. And in particular, the research was underway to discover how nerves transmitted an impulse from one nerve cell to the next. And to John Eccles, he got knighted too, he believed it was electrical. So the electrical impulse would travel down a nerve cell, and that electrical impulse would jump from that cell to the next cell, and on it would go. And he went to see Karl Popper and said, I'm very troubled because I think I'm wrong. And Karl Popper said, well, how so? And he said, well, these are American researchers who believe it's chemical, so that the electrical impulse changes to a chemical reaction, and this acetylcholine is released, and then the enzyme acetylcholinase, I think it is, breaks it down, but that transmits across the nerve cell. And Karl Popper got very animated, and together they worked out a critical test of the two theories, which of course is precisely what Karl Popper's method is all about. And John Eccles went on to do that critical test and went on to glory and indeed a Nobel Prize. And he went to, I think it was Oxford, to further his research. And he was traveling on a train and he heard these two esteemed Oxford professors discussing this young Kiwi upstart called John Eccles. How's he? Oh, he's a very good fellow, very good researcher, but he's a little strange. How is it that he's a little strange? The other one said, Well, he keeps going around trying to prove his own theories are false. Which is precisely the point we were at with this, right?
Exactly.
Because what we find here, particularly in public health, very narrow field. As you say, when they write a paper, they get just about every public health figure in New Zealand involved in its publication. And they don't open themselves up for criticism and critique as, say, would a scientist and indeed economists who are very open to criticism.
Yeah, I've published a little bit in public health, a little bit in health economics, which draws on people from public health, but most of my work is much more in applied economics. And economics is a very adversarial peer review process in general. Mm. So it takes a very long time. So economists generally don't publish a large number of articles. Their papers are long and getting much longer over time. They will often, and this has been to the detriment of New Zealand researchers in the last few years, but they'll often shop it around several places and conferences. Essentially, they're trying to get all of the objections, and then they're trying to overcome those objections, if not at the conference, then in an extra appendix or so on and so forth. And so they're building in from the outset the expectation that people are going to try and pull it apart. And so in the current situation for your listeners, we've had a number of esteemed public health commentators in New Zealand over the last more year and longer, then picked up by some politicians and some media who, as you said, have said, oh, look, New Zealand has uniquely negative cumulative excess mortality during the COVID-19 era. And so, Jane, for listeners who are not aware of the sort of background to this, when we say, okay, we've got deaths, we have actual deaths, and we can get them every Monday afternoon. Statistics New Zealand update their website with the latest deaths. These are deaths as they occur rather than as they're registered, which is a birth, death, and marriage. It takes a few weeks for the figures to become more final because there's a bit of underreporting and so forth. So we've got the actual deaths, and the issue is then, okay, well, what are we going to compare the actual deaths with, the so-called expected deaths, to work out if the actual deaths are under so-called mortality deficit or the actual deaths are over so-called excess mortality? And the normal standard is to look at some previous five-year period. And so throughout the COVID era, then most of the studies are looking at, the period from 2015 to 2019. And that's not just in New Zealand, that's in international databases around the world.
So, and you say, based on what has happened the last 5 years, this is how many people we'd expect to die this year.
Yeah, in the simplest possible terms, that's right. And then the questions come up as to say, okay, well, what things should we account for? And so there's really three things to think about. And so was there any trend in the death rates? Because from an individual's point of view, it's the death rate rather than the total number of deaths, because that's the risk of the average person dying if we're looking at all age groups. Okay, so you've got the death rates, you've got the population, and then you've got the seasonal pattern of deaths. And so in New Zealand, you're more likely to die in July and August than you are in February and March. And so the seasonal pattern is such that late summer has typically got quite a lot lower numbers of deaths, in the orders of 600 to 700s, and late winter. And so normally July is worse than June, and start of August is often quite high as well. Sometimes almost getting up to 1,000, we almost got up to 1,000 deaths 1 week in the last couple of years in that period. It's a very, very regular seasonal pattern, interrupted occasionally by different outbreaks of infectious diseases and so forth. Interrupted quite extensively by the interventions carried out in 2020 and onwards in terms of closing of borders and so forth.
Just that seasonal variation in death rates is interesting, isn't it?
So cold's more dangerous than heat. In general, cold kills far more people than heat.
But is it the cold, or is it what comes with the cold, i.e. you're staying indoors, you're not getting your vitamin D, you're getting flus, you're elderly, your immune system's breaking down, and when it comes to winter, you're more exposed and weakened to things that'll kill you? Why is it that well, I know it happens, but why do we die in winter?
Yeah, so that's a reasonably good memory of it. So the work that there's a group through the Wellington School of Medicine that was doing the healthy homes interventions.
Yes.
I'm just trying to think, Philippa Haldon Chapman, I think I've forgotten exactly the right hyphenated surname, I apologize. Arthur Grimes, a very well regarded economist, worked on with some of that as well. And so they were doing the subsidizing the insulation, the retrofitting of clean heating and so forth. And so they showed quite considerable improvements in health from there.
Okay.
So you know, houses that were warmer and drier in the winter, in general, because New Zealand's not so hot and so humid, then we don't have a lot of summer air conditioning. So some other countries do have a little bit of a summer peak as well, because people are again having to be indoors because it's so intolerably hot outdoors, and we have a much more benign climate, and so it's really the winter one that comes in.
So sorry, that was a digression, but
So if we go back to that, we really need to think about three things to work out the expected deaths. What's the trend, if there is any trend in the death rates in the prior period? What's happening to population, and what's happening to the seasonal pattern? And if we do population first, because this is really the nub of the issue, and if your listeners think back to pretty much about 2 years ago now, maybe a month before this, journalist, Charlotte Ballas, I think it was, the one who was pregnant and come back into the country, right? And New Zealand was pretty much completely locked to the outside world. Air New Zealand had taken most of their planes and mothballed them in the desert somewhere in North America. The number of flights to and from New Zealand was on a bare handful. People were having to go through the MIQ lotteries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So Statistics New Zealand, every quarter, make their best estimate from extrapolating from the census, which might have been, you know, up to 3 or 4 years beforehand, and also based on their various surveys that they have ongoing, based on movements across the borders and so forth, they make the quarterly resident population estimates. And so, for example, between the end of September 2021 and the end of March 2022, so over that 6 month period, the New Zealand population was completely flat. In fact, they estimate it was 500 people lower than it was 6 months earlier. And again, the estimates are the 500, they have a lot of rounding, need to do a lot of rounding of this, because they're not going and fully censusing everyone. And we've even seen when they do attempt to fully census everyone that they can't do it. So basically, one factor removed completely from the equation, which is that here was a completely static population at this particular time. Wasn't the case for all of the time from 2020 on, particularly starting in late 2022, the immigration taps started to open up. And of course, in 2023, then those taps opened up much more. But let's focus on this one very instructive period first. Okay. So that's the first. The second things that maybe needs to be accounted for is, well, what was the prior trend in death rates? And this one might be surprising to listeners, but if we focus on the all ages group, which if you're trying to pick an average person from New Zealand, that's the right thing to do, then the surprise to some listeners might be the fact that there was no up or down trend in the death rates. So the average person's risk of dying over time was unchanged if we drew an average each time. If we followed the same person, of course, that person's getting older, they're getting more risk of dying. But if we are just plucking an average person each year out of the population, looking at the risk of dying, then the all ages risk of dying wasn't going up at all. Okay, it wasn't going down, wasn't going up. And that surprises people, because people say, oh, well, the population's getting older and older people are more likely to die. Roughly 80% of all deaths in New Zealand occur in people aged 65 and above, roughly speaking. And it is indeed true that the above 65 group is getting to be a larger share of the population. What is not realized when people say, oh, aging of the population accounts causes more deaths, is that within each age group, there was a very significant downward trend in death rate. So people within each age group were living longer. Okay. And again, a simple thought experiment will help people to see this if they hadn't realized it before. And so when you were in Parliament, I'm sure there were debates about the sustainability of New Zealand superannuation, right? You know, can we afford to keep on paying this? And there's two sources of this. A larger share of the New Zealand population and a larger number of people, therefore, are eligible to receive New Zealand super over time, and it's growing. But the second part is that the life expectancy at age 65 has risen quite sharply. So in the mid-70s, when New Zealand superannuation was set up and roughly in its current form, from then until just before COVID, the life expectancy of a 65-year-old male had risen by 6.5 years. And the life expectancy of a 65-year-old female had risen by about 5.5. It was ahead and it remains ahead. And so female life expectancy is higher than male life expectancy, but the gain was slightly greater than for males and females. So basically, every 7 years past age 65, then you've gained an extra year of life expectancy because of general health improvements, technological improvements, medicines, et cetera, et cetera. Now, life expectancy and the death rate are just flip sides of the same coin. And so each age group had their life expectancy increasing, so the death rates were going down. That was then being offset by somewhat of a movement of the population into the older age groups, which have higher death rates. And the net effect was that there's no trend in the New Zealand death rate at all. Whether we go back to 2011 all the way to 2019, or we go 2015 to 2019, if we look at the all ages combined. So we don't need to make any adjustment to the death rates when we're projecting forward into the COVID period to say, oh, well, what do we expect? Because that had basically been a flat line. Okay.
Yep.
So then the only thing we need to do would be then say, okay, we just need to account for the seasonal pattern of deaths, the fact that weeks in July and August are more likely to have higher death rates than weeks in February and March and so forth. And when you do that, then it becomes very apparent that from late 2021 onwards, excess deaths in New Zealand started to rise quite sharply. Within 8 months, so by before the halfway point of 2022, then there had been a mortality deficit built up in 2020. So there were fewer deaths and death rates were lower than expected between about May and October of 2020 during the sort of first lockdown period. And so a number of articles and a number of public discussions suggested, oh, you know, we beat the flu and we beat COVID and so forth, and there was no winter surge and respiratory illnesses in New Zealand in 2020. And so there had been what we'll call a mortality deficit had been built up. Well, that had been completely erased by around about May of 2022, and that process of erasing it had really started back in late September, early October of 2021. Okay. Just yes. to carry on that for a little bit, your colleague Muriel Newman, who runs now the New Zealand Centre for Political Research. So in September 2022, I wrote a detailed article for them, which laid this out and said, you know, we've now crossed back over into positive territory and we've got a very large number of excess deaths, and I called it an unfolding disaster. Okay? Laid out basically the argument and the data. The thing which is surprising to me is that well, first of all, no one, you know, I'm not terribly important, but no one came and contacted me, no one from Ministry of Health, no one from the New Zealand media, no one from anywhere at all, right? And Muriel's readership, I think, is quite reasonable. A lot of people read NZCPR Weekly Index and so forth. So there didn't seem to be a lot of interest in finding out, well, why is he saying this? What's going on? And instead, we had, as I said, the public health commentators and politicians and media continuing for about another 12 months saying, oh, no, that's not the case. New Zealand is unique, almost unique in having negative excess deaths all the way through the first 3 years of COVID. So
just to stop the truck there, just to back it up and think about this. So the public officials and politicians are backslapping themselves about how well they've done. Right?
Yep.
And here is a paper saying, hang on, we haven't done as well as we think.
And indeed, we have an unfolding disaster, which was, you know, unattended to during that period.
And totally ignored.
Yeah, by and large.
Did that surprise you?
It surprised me with the persistence and the uniformity of which people were singing from the same sheet. And if we look now at what they were singing from, they were singing from a particular series, one of many, available from Our World and Data, which is basically an aggregator across various sorts of economic and social indicators. And that particular series is one of two on excess deaths that Our World and Data have available exactly on the same screen. You could touch one button, touch the other button, and you get a nice looking chart and so forth. And in that particular series, then what the authors, and the authors are people who really don't have New Zealand top of mind. So the authors were interested in creating worldwide estimates of excess deaths. And so they basically grabbed data from all sorts of different places. And for New Zealand, they didn't grab data directly from Statistics New Zealand or the Ministry of Health or Ministry of Internal Affairs or what have you. They grabbed data from what is much longer term research center, which is called the Human Mortality Database, which is a collaboration between University of California, Berkeley, probably the best public university in the world, and the Max Planck Institute for Demographic Research in, I think, Rostock, Germany. And I think the French Demographic Agency also contributes to it. And so the Human Mortality Database for years and years, if you wanted to go back and look at deaths in New Zealand during the 1957 pandemic or the 1968 pandemic, you could go and do that and you could compare them with deaths for about another 35 countries. And so they've got annual data going all the way back, in some cases going back to almost 100 years. Okay, but in the more recent period, because of the interest in these excess deaths in the COVID-19 era, then they also created a really nice database of weekly deaths for essentially for about 36 countries, mostly developed countries in the OECD, ourselves, Australia, Japan, a couple of other countries, Chile, a lot of the European countries, US, Canada, and so forth. Now, what the series used by the New Zealand public health commentators did is simply grab the total number of deaths per week for New Zealand from 2015 to 2019. And over that period, it was trending upwards, okay? Not smoothly. 2016 was below 2015 and 2018 was below 2017. But over that five-year period, then if we just compared, say, 2015 with 2019, it's about 2,000 more deaths per year. So it had gone up from about 32,000 to about 34,000. Now, remember, death rates were completely flat. So the average person had no greater risk of death during this period in New Zealand. It's simply that we had a rapid population growth rate. So population was growing at around about 2.1% per year, and the deaths were growing by about just under 2% per year. So they're almost going hand in hand. And so these guys, Kalinske and Kobach, are the names of the two people who wrote this paper and made this database, essentially just put a upward sloping straight line through that data and carried on projecting all the way through until 2021, 2022, and so on and so forth. Okay. And this is the series that the New Zealand public health commentators were using. And it was saying, oh, look, we don't have excess deaths. We're still in the negative, because what they had is far too many expected deaths, because there was no adjustment in this very crude extrapolation method for changes in the population growth rate. And of course, what happened in March 2020, the border was closed. Birth rates also have started to fall, whether it's people concerned about the uncertainty of the future because of COVID, because of climate change, because of the cost of living or whatever. So birth rates are considerably lower, and international border movements, which really dominate New Zealand population changes, were also very much lower. I'm a little reluctant to call them migration per se, because a lot of it is actually returning New Zealanders as well. Okay, and so it's just the contribution to local population growth coming from international border movements. So if we go back,
you have a numerator and a denominator, and they were projecting forward that the New Zealand population would grow as it had been going, as it had been growing, when in fact it flatlined because of the lack of immigration and
declining birth rate. Yeah, declining birth rate.
And so their denominator is wrong, and so their answer is wrong.
So if we focus on this particular interesting period from September 2021 through until, and if we go, just make it 5 months for this moment, if we go to February 2022, then Omicron arrived in New Zealand in late January of 2022, but it doesn't go from zero to 100 in terms of infecting the whole population in a matter of days. It takes quite a long time. And even once someone gets infected with it, the time from there, if sadly someone should die, also takes a quite number of weeks. Typically 21 days was being used in many studies when they're working backwards to try and work out what were infections, which were not being well tracked based on when were deaths. And so if we just go from September 21 to February of 2022, then COVID can't be a driving force, okay, for changes. And so excess deaths rose by roughly 1,000 in that period relative to a baseline of the average number of deaths in those same weeks of the year in 2015 to 2019. If we allow for the fact that the population was a little bit higher, so we use the death rates, then it's still an increase of several hundred. This misleading extrapolation-based approach, which assumed that a straight line from 2015 to 2019 in total deaths and carry on projecting ever upwards, implied that the population had risen by about 55,000 in a period where it's completely static, and a proportion of those 55,000 extra population are expected to die. Roughly, it projected around about 400 more deaths than the true situation would apply in that period. And so they hadn't adapted to this dramatic change in the circumstances of New Zealand, because they'd used this extremely crude indicator. The thing which is particularly puzzling is, yes, this very crude extrapolation's available from our world and data, but so too is another measure which simply uses the average number of deaths per week in the same week of the year from 2015 to 2019. So let's say week 30 of the year, which is somewhere into late July, is going to have more deaths on average than week 8, which is somewhere in towards the end of February. We've just finished week 8 in 2024. Then if you just average all of the deaths in 2015, 16, 17, 18, and 19 in week 8 of each of those 5 years, and do the same for in week 30, then you'll get an expected deaths for those periods. And that particular indicator shows that by the end of 2022, when public health people were still saying, oh, no, New Zealand's still negative, we're unique, by the end of 2022, we had cumulative excess deaths of 8%. By that period. And that 8% over a three-year period, we'd expect roughly 100,000 deaths. And so that 8% is roughly 8,000 people. Now, that's still not a particularly ideal measure, because that's saying, oh, the counterfactual is an unchanged population from 2015, 16, 17, 18, 19. And actually, we do have to allow for that. the most plausible and reasonable measure would be to look at the death rates. Because as I said, there had been no long-term trend in the death rates for all age groups. They were perfectly flat. So there's no need to make a projection forward from the death rates. You can just use the average death rate in each week of the year from the prior period. And when one uses the death rates, then you get, by the end of 2022, a cumulative excess mortality of just over 4%. So roughly 4,000 extra deaths than what have been expected. But if one uses this inappropriate extrapolation that the number of deaths continued to grow strongly because the population was assumed to continue growing strongly, then you can make all of those extra deaths disappear. You can make New Zealand stay below the horizontal axis.
We can all make mistakes, right? And but when a mistake is pointed out, we should and are expected to immediately correct for that mistake. And that's when the mistake in our analysis is trivial. Right? But this mistake that was made isn't trivial. It's like thousands of people dead that you said didn't happen, like in your public health official or a politician. So it's incredibly incumbent upon you to say, oh my goodness, I've made a mistake, right? And it's not a trivial mistake, and it's not involving a couple of dollars, it's involving death. I find it extraordinary that John Gibson's work gets totally ignored by, well, I don't get surprised politicians ignore it, but by researchers, academics, because they have to answer this critique, don't they?
One would hope so. There's another part to this which in some ways makes it even more puzzling. So I mentioned already Our World and Data, right? And this has become, you know, very popular. You see images downloaded from there and so forth. It's supported by Oxford University. The human mortality database, the people who have been doing this for far longer, right? The people who, the collaboration between UC Berkeley and Max Planck Institute and so forth, have an extraordinarily powerful visualization tool. And so if any of your listeners have a pen, just jot down these four initials, STMF, standing for short-term mortality fluctuations. And so the short-term mortality fluctuations visualization toolkit, they did a really fantastic job. And so you can select any one of 36 or so countries, including New Zealand. You can select the time period that you would like to be the reference period. And so typically it's been 2015 to 2019, but you could experiment with what if we went back to 2011 to 2019 for New Zealand. You can then select any particular year you want to focus on, whether you want to focus on 2021, 2022, 2023. You can select 10 different age and gender groups. And so 0 to 15 males, females, 15 to 64, 65 to 75, 75 to 85, 85 above, and all of the groups put into one. And I've focused on all of the groups put into one. And then the key thing is that you can select 6 different ways to make the forward projection. And as I said, in the New Zealand case, for all age groups, there had been a completely flat line in terms of death rates. There was no up or down trend, because even though the population was moving into the older age groups who are have a higher death rate, that was being counteracted by the fact that within each age group, there was a falling death rate. And so the combination of the between effect, which would raise the overall death rate, and the within effect, which would lower it, essentially counterbalanced to be no trend in death rates. So the most reasonable thing to do would be to simply take the average death rate for each particular week of the year, again, recognizing that July and August are more dangerous than February and March. And although these particular researchers, in New Zealand-based researchers, not the ones we're talking about currently, didn't use that database, there's a paper from 2020 from the Medical Research Institute of New Zealand. So this is separate from Otago and Auckland Public Health, paper in The Lancet, which was looking at the excess mortality in New Zealand during 2020. And lo and behold, what did they use? They used the week-specific death rates, the average from the reference period, exactly what one should do. The completely appropriate thing to do in a period where the population is static and there is no long-term trend in the death rates, the only thing you want to account for is the different weekly patterns. They did that, right? The data, the short-term mortality fluctuations database, and we would all have been in a better position if everyone looking at this, journalists, politicians, commentators, and so forth, had just focused on that, because it gives the entire rich menu of choices where people could, okay, what if we assumed this or this? What if we tested against this or this? Remarkably, it's the raw material, it's the upstream source for the data that are being used in this highly misleading extrapolation of an ever upward climbing number of deaths paper. And so the people who did this extrapolation paper, Kalinske and Kobach, simply grabbed one out of the very, very many data series available from the short-term mortality fluctuations, and off they did, and they did their own crude adjustment, which was completely unneeded because there were far superior adjustments built into short-term mortality fluctuations. Now, again, you might say, well, you know, Kalinske and Kobach were just trying to get a publication out. But the people in New Zealand, and so they're not terribly worried about, you know, New Zealand is a very unusual country. Most countries didn't have this dramatic slowdown in population growth rates in March 2020 that New Zealand had. And so amongst the 36 countries in the database there, we have the second largest population slowdown of any of those 36 countries. And so we're a country where this linear upward sloping trend is one of the least applicable places to do it. So we really should expect that the researchers who are focused on New Zealand should have been alert to the fact, well, hang on, where did these people get this data from? Oh, they got it from this well-known, long-established source, and this is showing an indicator which is completely different to the one we're publicizing. And this is the point I make about in economics, we would expect a researcher to already take account that some reviewer or some graduate student or someone who is being adversarial would hunt around for data coming from either the same source or the upstream source, which was telling a different story, and they would have brought that into the open and then said, oh, well, can you explain why you're only using one and not the other, and can you explain the differences between them? That hasn't happened in New Zealand. Everyone coalesced around this misleading projection-based approach, ignoring the data, the far superior data, which is an input into that, ignoring the data series that was parallel to it on exactly the same web page, literally within one thumbprint away for clicking the other link rather than the link that takes you to the negative story. So that's a puzzle.
Which I can say this and you possibly can't, which is suggestive of it not being a mistake, but of it being a choice.
You'd have to ask those people that. What I can say without, I think, causing any trouble for myself is one would hope that the public square or the system informing policy would bring in perspectives from multiple places which would quickly enable these errors to be eliminated, going back to our sort of Popperian discussion. And it seems that in the New Zealand case in the last 3 years, that has not been the case. And in fact, I think your colleague, Don Brash, in Bassett, Brash and Hyde wrote a blog or an op-ed, whatever we want to call them, pointing out that the New Zealand government, this being the previous New Zealand government, would have been the Ardern Robertson government, was receiving advice from fairly strange places, I think is something along the way sort of how Don put it. And he was essentially making the point that economists were being sidelined and the people who were providing so-called economic advice were not really research-oriented economists at all. In many cases, they were not economists at all.
You would be mortified to have made this, have this mistake pointed out to you if you'd done an economics publication?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And that would be just an everyday economics paper.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. People who, you know, whether for lack of thoroughness or for some other reason didn't reveal alternative sources which were telling a different story to the story they're focused on. The review process tends to drive that out increasingly. And again, this is not in all disciplines, but increasingly authors in economics are needing to submit their data and their sources and their code. So there is a big push towards open access, which is great. So, and my particular article is an open access article. So anyone can read the science coming out of public sources, but there's an increasing push also towards basically open science, which is essentially transparency. And of course, we saw with you know, Claudine Gay from Harvard, while yes, plagiarism was the key issue which brought her down, but there are also a number of plausible claims that her results don't reproduce. And so the reproducibility and the transparency of research are really things which are being pushed. But as I said, economics is perhaps ahead of some disciplines in that regard. So we wouldn't expect this sort of thing to occur in economics, I would say.
And the significance of this is here we are heading in for some sort of Royal Commission inquiry or some sort of inquiry into our government's handling of COVID. And here's the story being told that everything was hunky-dory, right? Well, one of the first things to do is to get the data right.
Yeah. And in principle, something like excess deaths is exactly the sort of indicator that a Royal Commission should look at, as opposed to narrow types of, you know, COVID deaths or something like that, because then all of the classification issues come in, or if, you know, extreme interventions perhaps reduced some COVID deaths but increased another type of deaths by even more, then we want to have the all-encapsulating indicator, and that's what excess deaths can do. So it is puzzling that the terms of reference, at least as I've understood them, don't have the term excess deaths in them at all.
No, because the thing about excess deaths is it was suggested at the start of lockdowns by critics that the lockdowns could lead to more suicides, they could lead to more alcohol abuse, overeating, lack of exercise, they could lead to delayed medical care leading to more deaths, they could lead to failure to have diseases assessed early enough, delayed assessment of disease, and all of this outside of COVID deaths could lead to more deaths. This was actually one of the arguments and criticisms of the lockdowns. Now, you couldn't pick that up if you're just measuring COVID deaths, but excess mortality would pick that up, correct?
Absolutely. And actually, again, one reason that I focus particularly on that late 2021, early 2022 period before large number of deaths can be attributed to Omicron. There had been, if you recall, in August of 2021, we had the Delta lockdown. And so there'd been a few other 2021 lockdowns. The New Zealand Association of Economists had their conference normally in June or July. I was there. And then the second day suddenly got abandoned because I think as some tourist in Wellington had tested positive out in the community. And so everything went down to sort of a mini a regional one. But then in August, there was a case of Delta in the community, and we went into this sudden additional lockdown. And The excess deaths do show a very brief mortality deficit then. And so there's most of the time through 2021 they've been sort of, you know, a little bit above and a little bit below the origin, the zero origin and so forth. But then there was a period of about 3 or 4 weeks where excess deaths were lower. So we fell back into the mortality deficit, but then that's quickly reversed. So if that says, well, okay, you can do a lockdown, but it's really unsustainable because it only gives you, it's simply shifting in time, deaths, putting them back a couple of weeks, and then it's adding even more deaths on top of that because of all of the collateral damage from the lockdown, then that really gets to the issue of the sustainability of so-called elimination strategies. Yet if you read the public health advocates who are using this misleading negative cumulative excess mortality graph for New Zealand, then they're very strongly arguing that this shows elimination was right, right?
Yes. And of course, it's suggestive that you should lock down every winter.
Yeah, exactly.
Tell me also, too, there's an issue. This, your work has to be, and it's credit, and a critique of your work, and a critique of the data, and a critique of our understanding of it, that has to be front and centre of a big chunk of the Commission of Inquiry.
One would hope, but as we said, you know, currently excess deaths isn't even listed in,
no.
in
goodness me. But also too, we can learn a lot, or we not learn a lot. We get a lot of suggestive. There's a lot of suggestive stuff in your analysis. First of all, about the number of excess deaths versus the recorded COVID deaths.
That's so there's more excess deaths than reported COVID deaths. And so that implies that there's something else afoot. And indeed, one of the big concerns with what the public health people have relied on, I say in the paper, they've coalesced around this misleading measure. So the one thing is kind of the headline thing. They said, okay, oh, we're still negative. We're unique. We're, you know, did best in the world, blah, blah, blah. And that really doesn't have credible standing at all. But there's another really crucial part to it, because their misleading measure misdates the timing of the excess deaths. It pushes the excess deaths back into 2022 and 2023, and it misses this rise in excess deaths from late 2021. Which is very apparent in the data, which have not been subject to adjustment for spurious population changes. So if one just looked at the basically the simpler data, you see a very strong upward trend going from late September of 2021 all the way through until July of 2022. In the later part of that, some of it clearly is coming from COVID and from Omicron, but at least for the first 5 months, where there was about 1,000 more deaths than would have been expected based on the same weeks of 2015 to 2019, then it can't have been COVID. It's got to be something else. And so if we're really being diligent and hunting for the source of these excess deaths, then that's a period where we'd want to turn our attention to. But if we rely on this misleading indicator that's saying, oh, no, you know, the whole story starts only in several months later in 2022 when Omicron, you know, overwhelms the bulwarks we've put up against it.
So it's not just the number, it's also the timing.
The timing, yeah. If we're wanting to diagnose what was going on, you've really got to look at the right period of time.
Also tell me, do we have any indication of the age of these excess deaths? Is there any way of knowing? Well, you can do it presumably by decile, and you can say, well, these excess deaths were older people, or was it across the board, or was it younger people? Is there any insight into that?
So I haven't done that in this particular study, but we do have that. And again, this is a huge value of the longer established and largely ignored in New Zealand database, the human mortality database, because that breaks it down into these 10 age and gender groups. So one can look and see whether it was, you know, 0 to 15-year-olds, whether it was 15 to 65-year-olds, whether it's a predominantly male issue or a predominantly female issue. And so that sort of work could be done. I haven't done that in this particular paper. I have done it previously, which suggested, for example, that the rise in excess deaths from late 2021 going into 2022 wasn't being experienced by the various very youngest group, the 0 to 14 or 0 to 15 group. It was being experienced by the prime age and the elderly.
And what's the prime age?
Prime age, the 15 to 65.
My goodness.
So working age. Now, and we know from overseas, where many more people have private health insurance, whereas, you know, many New Zealanders will rely on ACC and on public health. But many other countries, you know, majority of people are privately insured. And so we know from some of those other countries that the actuaries are seeing very strong rises in unexpected mortality from prime age working people who are insured. And so the insurance payouts are a kind of an early indicator of that, in a way which will be probably less diagnostic in New Zealand, because the subset of people who have health insurance in New Zealand certainly are not a random draw from the population, have private health insurance.
The interesting thing about excess mortality is that it's, you know, barring getting the numerator and denominator right, it's a hard number, right? It's a solid piece of information that you presented here. However, apart from looking at the timing, it doesn't tell you anything about what could be causing it.
Correct. To economists, that's less concerning than to some disciplines, because large parts of our discipline, not my own work personally, relies exactly on timing. If one's doing macroeconomics, time series econometrics, you're looking at the timing of some event and some outcome or something correlated with it. And so, indeed, we have a test due to a Nobel Prize winner he's now sadly deceased, but he used to visit the University of Canterbury regularly every spring, Sir Clive Granger, which is called the Granger causality test. And it doesn't really mean causality in the way that some other disciplines might use the term causality, but it's looking at precedence. Does X occur before Y occurs, for example? And so for economists, finding simultaneous timings or timings where one occurred before the other, and using techniques for detecting possible causal relationships between them, is not an unusual thing to do. I'm well aware that other disciplines say, oh no, we need to do exact experiments randomized between, you know, one person receives this intervention and the other person doesn't, and we track them and so forth. Unfortunately, almost all of the interventions carried out in the last 3 or 4 years didn't have that degree of experimental rigor. Even the clinical trials for the vaccines really deviated from normal protocols in quite substantial ways to reduce the informativeness of them. And so we actually do need to, by and large, look at non-experimental approaches to trying to work out what might have caused things.
Have we got any insight that this excess mortality is now going back to normal, going back to zero?
Not thus far. So in my the paper of mine, which, and I should put a little advertisement in, I suppose, you know, so the journal is called New Zealand Economic Papers. It's the primary journal of New Zealand economists. It's a peer-reviewed journal. And so the paper is open access there. I had initially written the paper in May of 2023, when these various claims were coming out, still coming out, saying, oh, we're still negative. And, you know, back more than 6 months earlier in that column I'd written for Muriel Newman Center, I'd already said we crossed into the positive territory by May 2022. So for more than another year, people were still claiming we were negative. And because of timing to update and revise the paper in response to the comments from the editor and two referees, then it wasn't until December of 2023 that I did the final version. So I added a postscript to the paper saying, well, 2023 saw a really large number of inward migration as the taps were well and truly opened up by Immigration New Zealand. Does that, and so the population growth rate was really quite large. Did that reverse the central issue? And by and large, the answer was no. So the trend which had been drawn from 2015 to 2019 was so steeply upsloped that it's still well over the end of 2023 population, even with that huge influx of migrants and other people coming across the border, returning New Zealanders and so forth. And so by and large, 2023 still shows a substantial degree of excess deaths, more than one third of which would be magicked away by using this misleading population trending indicator that's been popular. December 2023 was particularly high rate of excess mortality. Each week, roughly speaking, was more than 50 above expectation. Some weeks we were up to about 700, which is a really unusually high number of deaths in December. So for the month as a whole, for the December of 2023, the very, very solid excess mortality still. Overall, if you want to know, in 2023 for the whole year, there were only 4 weeks, roughly in late July, August, where we were not in excess mortality. For the rest of the year, very high rates of excess mortality of around about 8% over 2023. So sadly, at this stage, there isn't any sign of this starting to wear off.
And what are the actual numbers of extra people dead than what we would have otherwise expected?
Yeah, so in 2023, it's approximately 3,000. If you use a benchmark of the death rates from 2015 to 2019, because there's no need to put a trend into the death rates because they were static, and allowing for the population growth that had then actually occurred rather than this misleadingly high population growth, then we're looking at about 3,000 people in 2023. And how many that it was about 4,000. So, yeah.
So before that was the previous 2 years?
Yeah.
So that's 7,000 people.
Yeah, and different approaches will change that a little bit. Some people are starting to try and go back earlier than 2011 for the baseline and so forth. But you know, a small town's worth.
Extraordinary, isn't it? Tell me, looking at the timing, and this is the elephant now because we don't know the cause. Is the timing, and I'm not good on, I never turned up for a jab ever, so I don't know when they're available. Is this timing of these start, this upward trend in excess deaths, is it consistent with it being jab induced?
Possibly. So it depends on the period of lag that one would have from the timing of injections to the timing of deaths. So the initial rollout of jab one and two starts in August. Well, it really ramps up in August of 2021, I think it was. And the booster campaign followed pretty quickly thereafter. So many people in New Zealand, which is unusual compared with the worldwide situation, had been double jabbed and boosted before they first confronted the virus.
Yes.
Given you know, that it wasn't really until February of 2022 that Omicron is out and about in the community and starting to spread widely. And in other countries, many people have had the virus before receiving jabs, because the virus appears to have been circulating in late 2019, and certainly was circulating well before sort of the declarations and the big sort of coordinated efforts in February and March of 2020. So that makes New Zealand a particularly interesting laboratory because one can observe, at least in certain windows of time, the effects of the injection absent the effects of the virus circulating itself. The other thing to point out here is, you know, that the claims of so many millions who have been saved worldwide by the jabs and that are not consistent with what the experimental evidence, the randomized controlled trial, showed. So in the randomized controlled trial, which was short and ended after only a couple of months, more people died in the jabbed arm than in the unjabbed arm.
Yes.
Yeah. Not by much, because we're talking about 42,000 people roughly in the overall trial, and the total numbers of dead at that time, by the time they brought the trial to an end, was only about 40 or so, and there was a difference of 3 or 4 between the two jabbed two arms. I'll just follow up on that. So if we take the data, and everyone should understand that these companies, despite receiving millions of dollars, in subsidies to develop these products, and then receiving effectively billions of dollars of forced sales, with governments acting as their, you know, salesperson, and beyond that acting, you know, in some cases forcing people to take them, have never opened the data up for outside scrutiny. So all of the analyses and reanalyses of the trials have been based on secondary data. And what we know from the deaths, for example, and I did this calculation myself, if we could have redone that trial 100 times just with the numbers that they'd reported, the roughly 80 times out of 100 more people would die in the jab group than the unjab group. Now, normally listeners who do classical statistics will know that we would normally want to have 95 times out of 100 to reduce the risk of a type 1 error to a very low level, but that depends on the trade-off we're facing, right? And it's enormously unconvincing to have such a high rate of outcomes where it seems to be not doing as doing more harm than good. I'll just carry that one on because there was another published paper by Freiman et al., which looked at the injuries. And so it didn't look at the deaths data because, in a sense, the deaths data, there were just not very many deaths in the trials, and so there wasn't enough to get sort of precise answers. But the injuries data were such that there were more people who were injured, needing to go to hospital or needing to amend their daily activities, than the number of hospitalization visits that would be saved. And because sometimes the argument was made, oh, well, it didn't reduce transmission, it didn't reduce infection, but it saved the hospital system from being overwhelmed, right? And very quickly, the arguments kind of shifted to that. The Freiman et al. Paper and other papers along those lines as well say, well, that doesn't seem to be the case either. Just taking the trial data, reanalyzing the published results, not being allowed access to the raw data to do things more fully, more people present at hospital for harms done by these products than the good which has been done by reducing that. And so again, as an economist, you would say, well, there might be some people for whom it was a well-targeted intervention, but rolling it out across the entire population was really costs clearly were outweighing benefits. And so it's really hard to see how these arguments can be made of saving millions of people when we know the basic trial data, we're not consistent with that at all.
And that's the trial data?
Yeah, that's the trial data.
Oof, 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 my goodness me, goodness me. One last question, John. The excess deaths that we're experiencing now, what percent?
So cumulative excess deaths by the end of 2022 were 4%. Within 2023, that year alone, they were around about 8%. And so if we put them all together, you're getting close to 5% over 4 years.
Is that a sort of an anomaly historically or across different countries, Western countries, or is that sort of thing that can just happen?
So, we can answer that in two ways. If we look at previous pandemics and, you know, early on in the piece, one would get censored for saying, oh, we should be making some comparisons with influenza. And then for whatever reason, the powers that be said, oh, no, you can't do that. I see now in the US and in other countries, they are starting to make these comparisons. So let's do that. If we look at the 68 pandemic and then the 57 pandemic, then if you look at the deaths, and I've done this for New Zealand, then in the year of the pandemic, then yes, there's a slight elevation in the death rate. But in the year after, there's actually a depression because essentially what it's done is brought forward some deaths that would otherwise have occurred. Okay. And thereafter, it just goes back to trend. So the fact that we're seeing excess deaths 4 years after the initial thing, this is why I refer to this as the COVID-19 era. I don't refer to it to the pandemic per se or to even the virus, because it's a whole era of interventions, a virus and so forth, which has lasted 4 years, maybe going to last even longer, depending on the damages which have been done from these interventions. And so it's highly, highly unusual to be seeing excess deaths, elevated excess deaths, 4 years after the sort of initial cause period. That's not in keeping with what happened in 57, not in keeping with what happened in 68.
If we look
across countries, and again, you know, people like to do this saying, oh, you know, we did so great and others weren't negative and so forth. Amongst this group of 36 mainly developed countries, mostly OECD, some of the former Soviet Union, so the Baltic states, Slovakia, Czech Republic, and so forth, you know, New Zealand, Australia, Chile, Japan, Canada, US, and so forth. Our excess deaths cumulatively by the end of 2022 were actually not different from Germany, Denmark, Canada, Netherlands, Austria, Switzerland. There's a bunch of 10 or more countries where you couldn't actually say we did any differently than them. And one could say, well, that's kind of unexpected because we should have had various advantages given our isolation, given, you know, the timing when these things occurred in winter or just going out of winter for those countries, given their much greater population density, smaller houses, climate, which doesn't facilitate being outdoors and getting vitamin D, higher reliance on public transport. You know, New Zealand's got the highest rate of car ownership in the world. And this kind of, as you put it, you know, backslapping really isn't appropriate at all. And it requires serious work for, you know, Shane Retty and the people who work with him and for him and people who are working independently to, first of all, get beyond this myth which has been put out that, you know, we did so great and we had negative cumulative excess mortality when we didn't. That's simply an artifact from a really inappropriate way of treating the data, and get down to the serious work of trying to work out what really happened and then, more importantly, what to do about it.
How did we compare to that bad boy, Sweden?
So Sweden does have – so Sweden's figures do vary quite a lot depending on what one does with the population. And so we did better than them on this regard in terms of excess deaths.
Okay. So to summarize, there's no basis to backslapping and saying how great New Zealand did as we get day in and day out, because that is based on a derivative piece of work which assumed that New Zealand's population continued to trend upwards through the COVID era when the border was shut, there were no immigrants, and as it happened, the birth rate was falling. And when you adjust for what the population actually was, you find that we're in the same ballpark as every other country, despite having these typical advantages. When we compare our excess deaths to previous pandemics, 57, 68, the deaths occurred in the year of the pandemic, the excess occurred. And then the next year, you would have, negative excess mortality. That is to say, the people that died in that pandemic were actually, I don't know how to word this politely, old people who would be dying the next year. And so, cruelly, they lost a year of their life. And so when you got to that next year, they weren't going to die of the flu that year because the harder flu the year before had taken them, sadly. But it was a one-year thing. This pandemic, the excess deaths, have basically come after the real threat of the pandemic. And we're into what, John? The fourth year.
Yep.
And we've got a fourth year of excess mortality. The excess mortality is higher than the number of recorded COVID deaths. Meanwhile, our public health experts and our politicians and civil servants are backslapping themselves about how well we've done. This is a shocking story that we're yet to get to the bottom of.
Yeah, your listeners should make a fuss if that's of their nature. We should demand better from our officials, from our health sector, from these researchers. You know, this inappropriate measure was, roughly speaking, adding almost 700 people per year accumulating. So 700 in year one, 1,400 in year two, 2,100 in year three to the expected number of deaths. And so what that was doing, if you think of a board with two sides, total deaths, are these excess or not? Well, they're moving them out of the excess category and say, oh, no, this is explainable by the trend in prior deaths. And that really isn't justifiable given what was the situation in New Zealand and given the changes. And so demand better. Put these people on the spot.
Will you be making a submission to the inquiry with your paper?
I will send that. I should say I have this paper and a previous paper which showed the issues with the trials and showed that the New Zealand public had been very poorly informed about the nature of the testing of the vaccines. I had sent the previous paper to all of the ACT MPs of the previous parliament and half of the National MPs. Not one sent me anything, you know, handwritten envelope, handwritten note. It was peer-reviewed journal article from the leading economics journal in New Zealand from an economist who has, you know, some research awards, whatever you want to say. No one could be bothered to even reply, say, oh, thank you for sending that. So, obviously, there are many other people who have had more experience of bashing their head against what seems like a brick wall, and I salute them for their efforts, and I hope eventually that wall starts to crumble.
They're standing there dancing around with their fingers in the air singing la la la. John Gibson, Professor John Gibson from the Waikato University. Oh, my goodness. Of all the things that should cause us to lie awake at night, it's that. There's an excess mortality. It's persisting. Our politicians and public health officials are in denial. They've got a cognitive dissonance or something that says, no, didn't happen. Didn't happen. Didn't happen. La, la, la. The data shows otherwise, ladies and gentlemen. Send me a text, 2057, email me, inbox at Rally Check Radio. That was a very informative, very sobering analysis by Professor John Gibson of Waikato University.
keeping the COVID inquiry honest, it's time for the inquiry sessions.